This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, a conversation with Gary Wilson, contributor to Detroit Public Television's Great Lakes Bureau, on the latest budget proposal from the Trump administration. But first, Congressman Justin Amash discusses the investigations surrounding the Trump administration, health care reform, and other issues. We sat down Thursday at the Cool Family Community Center in Battle Creek, just before the Republican representative's scheduled town hall meeting. Congressman Amash, thank you very much for making some time for us.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's go back to a couple weeks ago. You made the statement that if, in fact, President Trump had tried to pressure FBI Director James Comey to back off of the Russia investigation or back off of any of these investigations, that perhaps that rose to the level of impeachment. Is there anything that's happened in these couple weeks that has made you rethink that or has made you think that maybe there is stronger evidence there?
I answered a hypothetical question and said if the allegations are true, yes, that was possible. But we haven't had an investigation yet. We need to get to the bottom of it and find all the facts. And whatever the facts bear out is where we need to go. So we can't make any judgments at this point. There's a special counsel now, and I've called for an independent investigation. I think that would be appropriate. But we don't have any direct evidence at this point. We should go through the investigations, and there have been a number of allegations. So let's go through it, and let's talk to Director Comey and others.
Do you think an independent investigation, independent commission is what you co-sponsored a resolution for in the House, should that be in addition to the special counsel, or do you think it would have been preferable to that?
I prefer an independent investigation to the special counsel, but now we have a special counsel and they can work hand in hand. The advantage of an independent investigation that Congress sets up is that it will be more public. And I think it's important that we have something public to address the concerns of the people I represent and the people that other members of Congress represent across the country. And if nothing untoward has happened, then that will be good for our country. And we can all move on and address the real problems that face our country.
Can you have too many investigations going at one time? Independent commission, special counsel, various congressional investigations. Can they get in the way of each other at some point?
You can have too many, yes. So in my opinion, you'd have the special counsel doing his investigation, and you'd have the independent investigation. At that point, you could set aside the Senate and House investigations and let the independent investigation take the lead.
But those investigations are somewhat in progress. Do you think that there is, you know, information sharing and those sort of things that, that could be helpful, some of what the House and Senate have learned?
Absolutely. Things that have already been learned could be shared with the independent commission.
In a follow-up question, when you were asked about impeachment, you were then asked if you trusted President Trump more or FBI Director James Comey, and you said, the quote here is, "It's pretty clear that I have more confidence in Director Comey." Now, there have been reports that next week when James Comey testifies to the Senate, he's going to say that President Trump asked him to back off the Russia investigation. If that's all we have is he said, where does that leave Congress at that point?
I think it leaves us in a difficult spot, and we're going to have to assess the character of the two men, and we're going to have to assess all the other evidence out there. I don't think that's on its own enough evidence. We need to have more discussions with more people, and it certainly does take us in a particular direction where maybe the level of concern is elevated, but at some point we have to have enough facts where enough people feel strongly one way or the other, and at this point we don't have that.
You are often quoting the Constitution in setting forth your positions and beliefs. As you read the Constitution when it comes to that very specific question of whether or not the House should move forward with impeachment, where do you think that that bar is set?
Well, it's a quasi-political, quasi-legal question. It's not fully one or the other. And I think ultimately it's up to Congress to decide whether the person is fit for duty. There are certainly allegations out there that could rise to the level, but again, I think that's for individual members of Congress to decide. It doesn't have to be a purely legal threshold. It might not be enough to convict someone in a court of law, but maybe it's enough to feel that the president is unfit. But we're not there.
Let me ask you about health care. We spoke with Congressman Upton recently. Both of you voted for the House bill to change the health care system, the American Health Care Act. Representative Upton was saying that he was hoping that he would see some changes made in the Senate. If you could pick a change or two that you'd like to see the Senate make before it came back to the House, what would they be?
Start over. I don't think this is the right approach for the American people. I also don't think the ACA is the right approach for the American people. The two proposals, the ACA proposal, which is law now, and the AHCA are very similar. They're not that different. And if we want to address the rising cost of premiums and address the concerns people have with the ACA, then we have to start over and try something totally different and work together as Republicans and Democrats to do that. But right now, we're just moving things around and renaming things. And I think that the new bill is marginally better than the ACA. But I don't think that either the ACA or the AHCA is what we need as a country.
If the AHCA came back from the Senate clean, you know, passed as it was in the House, and then you were talking about voting for final passage to go to the president, could you vote for it still?
If it came back exactly as it was,
yeah.
That's a determination I'll still have to make. I sent it to the Senate with hopes that they would make improvements, and I'm not making any commitment at this point, one way or the other.
Is there anything that you're concerned that the Senate would do that would make you go from yes to no on this bill?
Sure, because we're only at the margins here. It's marginally better than the ACA. So they could make it marginally worse with just a small change. I don't know what that change will be. I can't predict what the Senate will do. But it's not that hard to flip me from a yes to no on this, because it's only a marginal improvement over our current system.
You mentioned the goal of trying to bring down costs and premiums. You know, the CBO report has come back about 23 million more people not having insurance. Can you bring down costs and yet keep those people insured in some way?
I think so. And there are reasons to believe the CBO reports are not accurate or maybe exaggerated. If you look at the CBO score for the ACA, you'll find that they were off by more than 10 million people. When you look at their early predictions versus what actually happened. So I don't think we should take the CBO as gospel, and we should take it all with a grain of salt. What matters more is, do we have the right rules in place to provide for the greatest level of access while keeping costs down?
And how do you do that? Because those seem to be things that might be in tension, actually.
Well, I think you need to separate the concerns we have about people with pre-existing conditions from the ordinary insurance market. So health insurance needs to operate as a market system. And then for those with pre-existing conditions, we need to provide the necessary benefits to help them. And we shouldn't use our concerns for them to hamper the rest of the insurance market. We should try to provide benefits for them separately. And I think we can do that.
The government perhaps setting
yeah.
aside a pool of money that would pay for people who have a pre-existing condition and then therefore kind of isolates them from the market?
Well, one way or the other, they're going to be paid for. And Americans have decided that taxpayers are going to be involved in that. So rather than harming the entire insurance market to provide those payments, we should just directly provide those benefits separately.
You at your town hall meeting in Grand Rapids said that you thought that states should have a bigger role here. You told people that if the state of Michigan wants a single payer system, the state of Michigan should do that, but not necessarily Oklahoma.
Yeah, and I'm not advocating it for the state of Michigan right. either, but I do think that the state should have that ability.
How much do you have to account for the fact that there is a lot of, things that go across state lines here in terms of, people do move, for instance, and there is, there's trade between states, et cetera, companies set up and they sell all over the country.
Sure. And that's true with a lot of aspects of our lives. And we make do with the states handling a lot of things, despite the fact that people move across borders and that trade goes across borders. At the end of the day, we have to decide, are we going to have states or not have states? And if we're going to have states, then they should serve a purpose. And the framers of the Constitution believe they serve an important purpose of diversifying the country, of allowing experimentation across the country, and providing for maximum happiness by allowing people to decide for themselves how they want their government to work, rather than having some distant government decide it. And the D.C. government is certainly more distant to the people of Michigan than the Lansing government.
You have moving on to a different subject now, that you would like to see the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia, which President Trump finalized when he was on his trip, announced. You'd like to see that blocked. Why?
Saudi Arabia hasn't been a reliable ally. They have supported extremism throughout the world. And they have a terrible human rights record. And I believe that these kinds of sales should go to Congress for approval. We should have the representatives of the American people on the record deciding whether we should make these kinds of sales, because these weapons can end up in the hands of people who want to harm us or who want to harm innocent people around the world.
The State Department, when they issued their statement on the weapons sale, said that the long-term security of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf region need to be supported in the face of malign Iranian influence and Iranian-related threats. Is there something to that?
Well, I think that Iran has done a lot to cause concerns for the region. But at the same time, Saudi Arabia has done many things to cause concerns for the region and for the world. And if you look at terrorism across the globe, it is the Wahhabi-style terrorism that has really affected the United States and our partners, and certainly many people throughout the Middle East. The 9/11 attackers were not from Iran. They were largely from Saudi Arabia. So we need to be aware of the dangerous ideology that's being pushed out of Saudi Arabia. And we have to understand, of course, the balance of powers in the Middle East. But at the same time, we can't neglect our responsibility to make sure that we are not putting weapons into the hands of people who want to do us harm.
In general, are you skeptical of any deal where we are selling weapons to a foreign country, as someone who's in favor of limited government?
I'm always skeptical of it, yes.
As we speak on Thursday, President Trump has announced withdrawal from the Paris Accord. Do you think that's the right move?
We were never in the Paris Accord, because the Paris Agreement has to be ratified by the Senate, and no steps were ever taken to have it ratified by the U.S. Senate. If you look across the globe, country after country had ratification measures taken by their parliaments or by their legislatures. Yet in the United States here, which is supposed to be the beacon of the world in terms of being a constitutional republic, we decided that one person, the president, could sign us onto an agreement. And I don't think that's right, and it's not valid under our Constitution.
But is the agreement itself, the substance of it, the sort of thing the United States should be involved in, assuming that the Senate would have the opportunity to look over it?
The agreement is largely unenforceable. It's largely sort of just aspirational. And so there's not a lot of requirements in the agreement. I think it's the kind of thing that you bring to the Senate for a debate, because What matters is how it's implemented over time. It's not the agreement itself, but how it's implemented over time. And Congress is going to have to be involved in that. So you bring it to the Senate for a debate and you have a discussion about how this kind of thing gets implemented. And we haven't had any of that discussion, any of that debate. So at this point, I couldn't be supportive of an agreement like this.
You, as I mentioned here, you are getting ready to do a town hall in Battle Creek as we speak. You have been actually critical of some members of Congress who you say should be doing more of these. And you say it's important to listen to your constituents, hear what they have to say. But I wonder, you're someone who I think people know is pretty set in a set of beliefs that you have about how government should operate. Is there ever a time that you're in one of these town hall meetings and someone throws something at you where you say, you know, maybe I've got to go back and look at that issue because of what that person said to me?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And that happens every day. And in fact, it happens in my office as well, where my staff will bring up points that I didn't consider at first. But you do come to Congress with a set of principles. You run on a set of principles, and people elect you to use your judgment in accordance with the principles you ran on. We don't have a direct democracy here. I can't take a poll on every issue. I have to use my judgment and apply my principles. But there are many times at town halls where someone will bring up an issue that I hadn't considered, or an aspect of the issue that I hadn't considered, and that helps influence how I might vote on it, because I then apply my principles to the issue and realize that now I'm coming to a different conclusion.
Congressman Amash, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Justin Amash represents Battle Creek and Grand Rapids in the United States House. We recorded the interview on Thursday, just before his town hall meeting at the Cool Family Community Center in Battle Creek. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. President Trump has now released another budget proposal, and despite criticism of his original spending plan, Great Lakes programs are still facing cuts. We're going to discuss what that means with Gary Wilson, contributor to Detroit Public Television's Great Lakes Bureau. Gary, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Gordon. Good to be back with you.
Should it be a surprise at all that President Trump seems to have dug in a little bit here on Great Lakes programs and the Environmental Protection Agency, given that when he campaigned, he said the EPA was going to be an area where he would focus his budget acts?
I don't think so, Gordon. He was very clear in his campaign about his feelings concerning the EPA, that they were clearly in his sights. And it wasn't a minor mention throughout the campaign. It was something that he talked about a lot, and that the EPA was a big part of the problem that was inhibiting economic growth. It was out of control regarding regulations, all those things. So the fact that EPA is clearly in his sights as President Trump versus candidate Trump, I don't think should surprise anybody. And you only have to look at the Scott Pruitt appointment as EPA administrator. That sent a clear signal that Mr. Pruitt was coming in to turn that agency upside down, and they're still trying to do that.
There are Republican lawmakers from Great Lakes states who have raised concerns about these proposed cuts. But as you point out, many of the Republican senators from these Great Lakes states also voted to confirm Scott Pruitt as administrator of the EPA. Could you argue here that they should have known what they were getting?
I would take that position, and Senator Rob Portman from Ohio, and he's been a strong supporter of Great Lakes programs, especially on the funding side. And he's a conservative from a fairly conservative state that went for Trump. But I checked the record, and he clearly voted for Pruitt. He's in the confirmation in the Senate. He said he had talked to Pruitt and he had some insurances about the Great Lakes. But, this presidency is not following any script. So I think there's a little bit of gullibility there on Mr. and Senator Portman's part and others who thought that, candidate Trump was just going to you know, flip the switch and become a normal acting president, because we're clearly not seeing that.
Of course, the president's budget proposal is just that. It's a proposal. Congress still gets its say on this. Congressman Fred Upton was at the Mackinac Policy Conference this past week, and he gave an interview to the Gongwer News Service and said that there would be a fight over the Great Lakes money. The quote here is, "We're not going down without a fight, and frankly, we're not going down. We're going to make sure we win this battle." How confident should a supporter of Great Lakes programs be, or how reassured should they be by that quote from Congressman Upton?
Well, I looked back at Congressman Upton's statement when this budget was released, and he expressed, and I'm quoting, concern about the president's budget for the budget cuts for the Great Lakes. But the rest of the statement was a little soft. He said he was going to, you know, work for common sense, for a common sense budget. So now he's upped his game a little bit. I think there's a reasonable expectation that most of the budget cuts for the Great Lakes, if not all of them, taking it back to $300 million, will be in the final budget. I talked a few weeks ago with Tim Eder, the executive director of the Great Lakes Commission that works for the governors, and also David Ulrich, who ex-APA employee who leads a group of Great Lakes mayors. And they had just returned from Washington, D.C., and they were both fairly confident that a good portion, if not all, the money would be in the final budget. Now, the test will come when Congress sends the president the budget, and he's got to sign off on it. And who knows what the back channel discussions will be. So I think there's a reason to be cautiously optimistic.
Does this get back to a question that I think you and I have discussed before, which is how big a priority is this, maybe on both sides? You know, is this something that President Trump, in trying to get a budget passed, he's got to decide how much he really wants to fight to cut programs to Great Lakes initiative and that sort of thing, as opposed to doing other things? And lawmakers have to decide how important it is to keep that funding. I mean, and then does the question become, where does Great Lakes funding fall in the great span of things that both sides are trying to do?
Well, there's one thing to consider, and it doesn't get a lot of play in the region here, but the president's budget also proposed cutting out funding for other what are known as great waterways in the country, the Chesapeake Bay, San Francisco Bay, Puget Sound. The Puget Sound folks have been very vocal. So there's a basis there for members of Congress in these other regions to band together with the Great Lakes, you know, to argue for putting this funding back into the budget. Now, the Great Lakes happens to be the biggest slice of it, $300 million. I want to say San Francisco Bay, off the top of my head, was $4 or $5 million. Puget Sound, maybe 15 or 20. Somebody can fact check me on that, but nowhere near the amount that the Great Lakes get. So there is some, you know, some crosstalk between members of Congress of the in these regions. So there's an opportunity there to, you know, to work together to take this on.
Is there then maybe a bigger argument about whether all of this, you know, the Great Lakes, Puget Sound, San Francisco Bay, whether all of this is in the national interest? Could that be the next debate about whether or not this is a federal responsibility, or whether or not maybe each state, each region should be focusing on the waterways which are adjacent to them?
Well, that would be a version of the Trump administration's proposal on this. Presidential Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, when the budget was released, he, in a statement in the budget itself, the narrative, he talked about the fact that the Great Lakes have received over $2 billion in the past 8 or 9 years, part of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, Obama's program, and it's time now to turn these programs back over to the states. I think these waterways are in the national interest. It's just, you know, you got to have good management of it. You have to be good stewards of the money. One of the things that I'm hearing is from some people is the Trump administration administration really did itself a disservice if it wanted to go after these programs. Instead of just taking an axe to them, they should have been more circumspect and said, look, for the Great Lakes, for example, this program is 9 years old. It's never had a serious review. Let's take a look at it, see what works, see what doesn't, you know, tweak it where it needs to be tweaked, eliminate some things that may need to be eliminated. Other things may need to be bolstered. With that approach, they would have had a lot more credibility. But when you just come in with an axe and whack everything out, that puts people on the defensive, and you get disparate parties like Senator Stabenow and Representative Upton, you know, working on the same page to defend their turf. That's not the best way to govern.
If there was a full-scale review of Great Lakes restoration and other initiatives, can supporters point to some real success stories there that would make the case that, yes, this is worth federal money, worth the nation's taxpayers giving some of their money up to support these programs because it resulted in X?
There definitely has been success, Gordon, and in one area in particular, and that's all of these old legacy toxic hotspots that dot the Great Lakes region, mostly in the U.S., but some in Canada. Those sites were officially listed as areas of concern in 1987, and nothing was done with them, essentially, for cleanup until the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative became law in 2010. White Lake in western Michigan is a prime example. Waukegan Harbor here in Illinois. And there have been tens of millions of dollars put into remediating those sites. And they are no longer on that list of toxic legacy sites. And that not only cleans up the waterways in the surrounding areas, but it also facilitates economic growth. What business or other entity wants to invest in an area that's, you know, got legacy contaminants from the industrial era there? They just won't do it. So that's the key success of this Great Lakes program.
So there's the money, but there's, of course, also regulations and rules and those sort of things. Where do you see that going under a Trump administration with Scott Pruitt as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency?
That's going to be the tough one. There's a clear move to roll back regulations. And even if they aren't rolled back, as we all know, federal bodies, state bodies, can aggressively enforce regulations, or they can look the other way on regulations, and that's really the key things. The key thing: regulations are preventive; they prevent pollution. The money for the Great Lakes restoration is cleaning up the work that was needed to be done decades ago. So, the folks I know who are really tracking this are really concerned about a lack of regulation and enforcement from the Trump administration writ large and Scott Pruitt at the EPA in particular.
You often told us that President Obama was the best friend that the Great Lakes ever had. Are we maybe really seeing now how true that is with a new administration coming in and the changes that they are trying to make to some of the things which happened under President Obama, as well as under President Bush?
I agree. I stand by that statement. I said it many times. President Obama was the best friend the Great Lakes ever had. President Bush was a better friend than most people thought of him at the time. President Bush did receive a lot of criticism for being a Great Lakes supporter, but not for not funding the work. And now the pendulum has swung all the way the other way. So that really speaks well for former President Obama.
Gary Wilson, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Gary Wilson is a contributor to Detroit Public Television's Great Lakes Bureau. A link to his story on the proposed funding cuts to Great Lakes programs can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.